Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 2, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call. Today, we're hosting a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, and we'll be discussing today's oral argument in the Whitfield case, the forced accompaniment case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We are happy to welcome back with us today our expert, John G. Malcolm. He is the chairman of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group. He is also the director and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindberg Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow and Edwin Meese the Third Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And we're very happy to have him here. He's attended oral argument earlier today. He's going to give us some background on the case, discuss the argument, take about 15 minutes or so in doing that. And then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please do be ready with your questions. With that, Mr. Malcolm, go right ahead.
Thank you, Dean. Well, the court heard argument today in the case of Whitfield versus United States, which involved a failed bank robbery with some tragic consequences. The statutory background of significance is as follows. A conviction under the federal bank robbery statute carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison and no minimum mandatory sentence. However, under one provision, Title 18 United States Code Section 2113E, if the bank robber, quote, in avoiding or attempting to avoid apprehension for the commission of a bank robbery, quote, forces another person to accompany him without the consent of such person, then there is a minimum sentence of 10 years in prison and a maximum potential sentence of life imprisonment. Here are the basic facts of the Whitfield case. On September 26, 2008, Larry Whitfield and another guy named Quantarius McCoy decided to rob a credit union in Gastonia, North Carolina. But as they attempted to enter the credit union, a metal detector triggered an automatic lock on the inner doors. Whitfield and McCoy attempted to drive away, but McCoy lost control of the car and got stuck in a median. The two men fled on foot into the woods, separated, and discarded the firearms that they had with each other. At first, Whitfield hid in the home of a woman named Tina Walden, who was away at work. When Walden returned home, Whitfield confronted her at the front door with a kitchen knife in his hand, which caused her to run away. Whitfield then discarded the knife and also fled. He entered the nearby home of Mary and Herman Parnell and found Mrs. Parnell, who was a 79-year-old woman with heart disease and high blood pressure, home alone. According to statements Whitfield later made to the police, Mrs. Parnell became upset and began crying when she saw him, but he told her that he didn't have a weapon and wasn't going to harm her, and that he just needed somewhere to stay. Again, according to Whitfield, he asked Parnell where in the house they could go where the police would not observe them, and when she pointed towards the computer room, he told her to go into the computer room and accompanied her there. The computer room was just a few feet away from where they were standing. According to Whitfield, Parnell sat down on a chair while Whitfield went into another room to send a text message to a friend who agreed to pick him up. During a subsequent call, the friend testified that she heard Whitfield say to Mrs. Parnell, "Ma'am, just calm down. I'm probably more scared than you are, and I'm actually just trying to leave." Eventually, Mrs. Parnell got on the phone to give the friend directions to the house. The friend testified that Mrs. Parnell sounded calm and was relieved to learn that the friend was nearby. The friend, however, was not able to reach the home because the police had blocked the street. While still on the phone with the friend, Whitfield said that Mrs. Parnell had stopped breathing and seemed unconscious. A few minutes later, a neighbor who was an off-duty police officer went and rang the bell and knocked on the door of the Parnell's home to try to tell the Parnells that there had been a robber spotted in the neighborhood, but nobody answered. So the neighbor then left. This prompted Whitfield to flee out the back door into the woods, where he was apprehended shortly thereafter. When Mr. Parnell returned home, he found his wife dead in a chair in the computer room, having suffered a fatal heart attack. The jury convicted Whitfield of various charges, including the crime of forced accompaniment of Mrs. Parnell, resulting in her death while trying to avoid apprehension for the attempted bank robbery. The district court sentenced Whitfield to life imprisonment, which was the mandatory minimum sentence for a 2113E violation when death results. On appeal, the Fourth Circuit vacated the death results portion of the conviction, finding that it had not been properly charged. However, with respect to the forced accompaniment charge, the court upheld the conviction and stated that although Whitfield required Mrs. Parnell to accompany him for only a short distance within her home and for a brief period, that was enough to affirm the forced accompaniment portion of the conviction. On remand, Whitfield was sentenced to 264 months on that charge, plus another 60 months tacked on for a 924C violation that was carrying a firearm in relation to the attempted bank robbery. Had he been convicted of simple bank robbery rather than aggravated forced accompaniment, his guideline range on that offense would have been only 70 to 87 months, and he would not have been subject to the 10-year mandatory minimum. So the question presented to the court was whether Section 2113E's forced accompaniment offense requires something more than just de minimis movement by the victim. Two circuits, the Fifth and Tenth Circuit, have held that there has to be some substantial movement that occurs, more than what occurs in say, a typical robbery, while the Fourth Circuit, Seventh and Eleventh, have held that any forced movement, any forced accompaniment will trigger the increased penalty. Whitfield's argument essentially is that Congress, in enacting 2113E, could not have intended such an enhanced penalty to apply to mere de minimis conduct, especially conduct that is typical in most bank robberies. Whitfield had noted that when the statute was originally passed, the forced accompaniment charge was a potential capital offense. However, Congress amended this in 1994 so that it's obviously not death eligible. Defendant argues that the text structure and purpose indicate that enhancement such as this is reserved for a defendant who forces a victim to travel with him for some kind of a substantial distance, and that the word accompanies suggests some kind of a substantial movement. He also notes in his briefs, although it didn't come up in argument today, that part of the impetus for passing this statute, which was enacted in 1934, was after a spate of bank robberies by the infamous John Dillinger, who took hostages as human shields. The defendant also argues that a contrary interpretation would produce some absurd results, such as if a robber ordered a teller to take a few steps and then followed her, thereby accompanying her, he could be punished more than if the bank robber had simply stood there and either shot non-fatally the teller or pistol-whipped the teller. Finally, his fallback argument is that if nothing else, the rule of lenity requires the court to interpret the statute narrowly and to resolve any ambiguity in the defendant's favor. The case for the defendant was argued today by somebody from the Federal Defender's Office in North Carolina, Joshua Carpenter, and he was treated skeptically, shall we say. Justice Scalia began by saying, why is this justified in the text? After all, I can use the word accompany as in, I accompanied my wife to the table, and there is no spatial requirement that it be any particular distance. Counsel said, yes, there was a spatial requirement. Scalia said, look, I don't see it. This may be a foolish statute, but it doesn't seem vague to him. And, you know, what would the rule be? He asked the defendant's counsel, what should the rule be in terms of accompanying? And he said, well, it should involve substantial movement, something more than de minimis. Carpenter received a number of questions from Justice Alito and others that would sit there and say, how would you fashion such a jury instruction? How would you tell the jury what was substantial and what was de minimis in this context? About the best he got was a Carpenter responded, well, this should be left to the jury, and the jury should be given various factors to consider, such as what was the distance that was traveled, and was this person transported from one place to another, akin to a kidnapping. A number of the justices said, look, really, what Congress was getting at by enacting the statute was not how far somebody would have to travel, but the fact that by being forced to accompany the robber somewhere. This would put additional stress on the victim. It would be a more traumatic experience. It dramatically increases the likelihood of future injury or death, either from the robber himself or if, say, the police burst upon the scene and were trying to apprehend the robber and shot at him. If you were in close proximity to the robber, it would increase the likelihood of being hit, and that it was this sort of conduct that was designed to that warranted the enhancement. There were really no very, very satisfactory answers to this from Carpenter, and you know, Ginsburg in the end says, it seems to me that what Congress wanted to get at is exactly what happened here. A terrified woman is forced to move and ends up having a heart attack, and Carpenter kept coming back to that just about every robbery involves telling a teller to do something, and if you take a few steps in that direction, all of a sudden you've gone from simple simple robbery into this enhanced penalty world. The government's argument, on the other hand, is that indeed by forcing Mrs. Parnell against her will into the computer room and by accompanying her in an attempt to avoid apprehension for the attempted bank robbery, the defendant was guilty since the statute contained no requirement about the distance that the victim was forced to go. The government argues that the word accompany just implies joint movement, not going to any particular distance, and that Congress recognized that the mere act of being forced to accompany a bank robber somewhere is a terrifying and traumatic experience that increases the risk of death or injury, thereby warranting the enhanced penalty. It's also different from a typical bank robbery in which a robber may direct the teller to go and do something but doesn't accompany the teller. The government also argued that sentencing judges can easily handle anomalies such as the one who pistol whips the teller without moving is not subject to the minimum mandatory penalty by sentencing those people appropriately, and that in this case the rule of lenity should not apply since the words are not vague. The government's case was argued, hang on one second, by Assistant Solicitor General Brian Fletcher. He was asked several times, including by the Chief Justice, does this make any sense when robber number one pistol whips a teller and there's no minimum mandatory offense, but robber number two, who tells a teller to move 2 feet and accompanies her, is immediately subject to a mandatory minimum penalty. Mr. Fletcher said that the mandatory minimum penalty in this case fell within the mid-range of the statutory maximum, the potential statutory penalty for such an offense, and that Congress obviously thought that it was more serious to treat somebody who has forced somebody to go through that additional potential danger and trauma of a forced accompaniment through an enhanced penalty. A lot of the argument taken up during the government's portion had to do with a great deal of skepticism by the justices about prosecutors' use of minimum mandatory penalties. Justice Breyer got this conversation started by essentially saying, look, this is a mandatory minimum penalty, and it gives prosecutors a tremendous amount of leverage to basically force a guilty plea for what can be de minimis conduct, such as, you know, telling somebody to move 2 feet against their will and accompanying them, and this was picked up by a number of the other justices. Roberts asked about it. Alito asked about it. Several of them jumped in and said, "Isn't this really going too far?" Fletcher's argument essentially was that Congress can do this if it wants to, that there is absolutely no pattern of prosecutorial abuse about charging this minimum mandatory after de minimis movement, which prompted Chief Justice Roberts to say, how would you know? Because the threat of the minimum mandatory is what induces people to plead guilty, and a lot of people who plead guilty end up waiving their rights. Counsel said that he was basically aware of that. However, Congress knew that forced accompaniment was under most circumstances going to involve threats of physical force or the use of a weapon, and that that was somehow worse, and that this was very different from just telling a teller or a customer to go somewhere and sit down or go to a vault and get money. At the very end of the argument, Justice Kennedy said, look, what if there was a lot of evidence that existed that prosecutors were, in fact, abusing this authority by charging or threatening to charge mandatory minimum penalties for de minimis conduct of the sort? You move 2 feet, all of a sudden you're subject to a 10-year mandatory minimum. And Fletcher's argument essentially was, look, this is not the court's role to make these charging decisions or to limit discretion, and that the court really, that while he understands why such conduct might give the court pause, at the end of the day, it's the court's role to engage in statutory interpretation. I'm not a betting man, but if I were a betting man, I would bet that Mr. Whitfield is likely to lose this case. He did not have a lot of people who appeared overly sympathetic to the arguments that he was making. And while the court certainly gave the government a very hard time about the potential abuse of mandatory minimum penalties, they didn't really appear to have much of an appetite for engaging in, you know, restrictive statutory interpretation in order to alleviate that problem. And with that, let me open it up to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, John Malcolm, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see who rings in, let me make a quick commercial announcement for our upcoming schedule of Teleforum conference calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about immigration and the limits of executive authority. We'll have a panel of experts, four folks, talking about President Obama's most recent executive action on immigration. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. And Thursday at 1 p.m., we'll be talking about yet another Supreme Court case, this one not yet argued. It's the Amtrak case, better known, I think, as DOT versus AAR, and it raises a possible non-delegation doctrine issue, which I think should be very interesting. Today, of course, we're talking about the Whitfield case, the forced accompaniment case, with John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation. If you have a question, push the star button, and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me, while we wait to see if some folks ring in, let me ask you this, John. Was there any discussion at all about when a bank robbery ends under the terms of the statute? I mean, in this case, they left the premises of the bank. I take it from your description of the facts, this particular person, Whitfield, entered one home and then left there after some period of time and entered a second home. By this time, he had no weapon. I mean, I can imagine a case where somebody holds up in a house for a day and then the people come home and the same facts ensue. But it's a second day. I mean, did that play a part at all in the argument or in the lower courts?
No, and I think the reason for that is because the statute speaks in terms of avoiding or attempting to avoid apprehension for the commission of a bank robbery. So I think that even if you are hiding out for a day, you can imagine Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid sort of on the lam, out in the Badlands for several days, that is a continuing course of conduct designed to attempt to avoid apprehension. So I don't think that that would be a matter of great concern in this case.
And it sounds like it doesn't even have to be a continuing course of conduct. It could be years later, really, that you've maybe lived incognito or something like that, and then you're discovered and you're on the run and you force someone to accompany with you. That would fall under the statute, your sense is?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, that's the more interesting case about when your justifiable fear and attempt to flee ceases to exist, but you are, of course, correct that if all of a sudden you're living in a community for a month or two, and then you catch wind that the police are on to you and you continue your flight, whether you had then what's more fit within that statute, and I think the answer to that would be probably yes.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to join the conversation with John Malcolm. How much would your sense emphasis was placed on the outcome, the very unfortunate outcome that there was a death involved here? That's probably directly related to the fact that this man entered this home. I don't know that it's directly related to the fact that she was made to move from one room to another, but ultimately she suffered a fatal heart attack. I know that was discussed in argument. Was there a lot of emphasis placed on that, that it was such a bad outcome, and that one of the purposes perhaps of this statute was the attempt to reduce the danger which people are put to from a forced accompaniment?
Yes. In fact, I think that Carpenter kind of changed gears. He began by saying, essentially, look, how can you have a 10-year mandatory minimum and a dramatically enhanced guideline range from forcing a woman to move from a hallway into a computer room, which he estimated to be somewhere between 4 feet and 9 feet. Scalia immediately jumped in at that point and said, you know, a woman died here. And part of the stress that might have caused that heart attack was forcing this woman against her will to go into a room followed by the robber. And several other people picked up on that, so much so that when Carpenter got up for his very, very brief rebuttal, he cited to the old Holmes quote about, you know, bad facts. I think he said sad facts, but bad facts make bad law, which was a nod to the fact that, yes, there had been really bad outcome here, but because of that, the fortuity, if you will, of that really, really bad outcome, then the sentence enhancement was dramatically unfair. But yes, I think he started down the tack of saying, you know, gee, how can there be such a dramatically enhanced sentence for just telling somebody to go from a hallway into a computer room? But, you know, immediately it was the trauma and the stress, and, you know, you take your victim as you find him, and this woman had a heart attack as a result of all of this. I think that put a stop to that line of argument pretty immediately.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. Our lines are open. Here we have a question from the audience. So before I ask another question, let's turn to our audience for a question here.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. Insofar as this case presents a question of statutory construction, do you see this argument and the questions posed this morning is giving any insight to how the court might approach perhaps a more significant statutory construction case that's on its docket, and that is the one that involves the meaning of exchanges established by the states under the Affordable Care Act?
No, I don't think you can read too much into that. I mean, I thought the case you were going to mention was the Yates case, which is the Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, document shredding provision that was applied to undersized grouper. You could say the same thing with respect to Burwell versus King, which is the Obamacare case. I mean, I think you have to not only look at the words of the statute, but to see them within context of other provisions to see whether, within that context that illuminates what it is, what meaning is to be applied to those words. The defendant in this case tried to make an argument that the text and structure of this statute implies that it was not meant to apply to such de minimis conduct, but he really didn't have much of an argument in that regard. It was really much more in terms of, gee, when they passed this provision, this was capital eligible, therefore Congress must have intended this to apply to really serious conduct, and really serious conduct was lacking here. So I don't think in terms of the kinds of analysis that the court will undergo in both Yates and in the King versus Burwell case, there was much of a hint about comparing this provision with that provision and what it all means that I think will be involved in those cases.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I'm going to make this the final call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. I don't see any more questions. John, you want to take a minute to express any final thought or wrap up?
Well, this was an interesting case. I don't think it had quite the sex appeal of the Alonis argument yesterday, but as always, it's an entertaining time at the Supreme Court, and they actually had a very, very interesting trademark case argued immediately before very skillfully by Willie J. and Neil Katyal. So I'm glad I got to go to the court and spend time with you all, and I appreciate, as always, Dean, the invitation.
Well, my thanks to John Malcolm on behalf of my own behalf and on behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate, John, you making the effort to make it to the argument. Glad you had a good time there. Thanks to our audience for dialing in, as always. And a reminder that our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for 2 o'clock tomorrow, when we'll be talking about the president's recent action on immigration. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow Eastern time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.